Hello, listeners. No, sadly, And Just Like That isn't randomly back with an early episode, but I do have something fun to share. My friend Patrick and the immensely talented Broadway star Jennifer Simard, coming back to Broadway this season in the musical Death Becomes Her with another of my favorites, Megan Hilty. Oh my God, I'm so excited. Back to the topic at hand. Patrick and Jennifer have a new podcast called The Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast. In it, they'll be recapping The Golden Girls, for sure one of the all-time great television comedies, and providing a deep dive into the Golden Girls universe. The first two episodes are out now, and you can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, a quick moment of self-promotion. I have an album out in the universe. You can find Mike Jensen's Looking Back on a Possible End wherever you get music. And don't forget that Elise and I have been recording our Patreon podcast, We Couldn't Help But Wonder, Still Wondering, for the past year. We're actually wrapping up that project this month, but for $4, you can hear all of our episodes, including a look at When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, Moonstruck, The Way We Were, and our latest, Fatal Attraction. Check that out by going to patreon.com. Okay, here's the first episode of the Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast.
Jennifer Simard.
Hi, Patrick Hines.
I love you so much.
I love you more times two plus one.
Oh my goodness. I didn't even let you get all the way through the math equation.
Google infinity.
So girl, why don't we start by explaining what this Golden Girls Deep Dive podcast even is, and we can also like tell them a little bit about who we are.
That sounds great.
So the idea of the Golden Girls Deep Dive podcast is that we're starting from the beginning of the series and we're going to go in order. So each episode, we're going to recap an episode of the Golden Girls and we're providing our hilarious commentary and looking gorgeous doing it.
I love that you gave us like a hilarious, hilarious commentary starting now. But it isn't your typical recap show. No, sir, no, ma'am.
No.
Because we have a full-time researcher. Thank you very much.
On Hi, our staff. Jess.
So throughout the recaps, we're going to be squeezing in every last piece of trivia and all the interesting info we can.
We get like a full dossier on the episode. So like into like our recordings, like we have so much to tell you in addition to just like being silly.
And then the other thing is though, Patrick and I go and we do our own research and then we don't tell each other what we found. And so Jess gets us going and then we go and like, I think one of our things we've realized is like, how far are we going on this deep dive?
How deep is this deep dive going to be? But then also at the end of each episode, we then do a full like 15 minute deep dive into something from the Golden Girls universe. So at the end of today's episode, I'm doing a full deep dive on the actor Charles Levin, who played Coco the Gay Chef. Like, he had this amazing career after sort of getting fired from the Golden Girls.
I know, we're like, where's Coco?
I know, but then he like died kind of mysteriously. So we're going to do things like that. There's going to be deep dives on like the Betty White, B. Arthur feud.
All the juicy stuff.
All the juicy stuff.
Now, the other thing we want you to know, though, is that we want to connect with you.
Yes.
Please, right? So join our Facebook group.
So the Facebook group is called the Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast Discussion Group. It's on Facebook. We're going to be in there all the time, just like hanging out, talking to you, talking about the episodes, sharing all the Golden Girls memes, everything that you can think of. It's going to be the place for our community to come together and connect.
Right, and follow us on Instagram and TikTok to see the video versions of these hilarious moments,
hilarious moments
from the episodes. And we'll follow you back and it'll be great. We are at Golden Girls Deep Dive in both places, on TikTok and on Insta.
So girl, I guess we should also, for those of you who don't know us, we should tell you a little bit about who we are.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You go first.
Okay. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm the co-host of a true crime podcast called True Crime Obsessed. I recently wrote a book called Failure Is Not an Option, which is like a comedy memoir about, it's like the 12 funny stories I tell at cocktail parties about like big epic failures in my life and sort of like the lessons I learned from them. And one of them includes a story of spending like an evening with Bea Arthur and I was obsessed with her and the feelings were not mutual. She did not like me very much at all.
Yeah.
Tell them who you are, star.
Me. Thank you for that. No, I'm Jennifer Simard. Hey, how are you?
Well, give them some credits.
I will. It's hard to do it when it's talking about yourself.
I know.
But I'm a two-time Tony Award nominee.
Yes.
I'm primarily a Broadway actress.
Are you going to tell them what you were nominated for?
Nominated for Disaster, where I played a nun with a gambling addiction. And I was nominated for Company, the revival of Company, where I played Sarah.
Do you know that Steve and I saw Disaster off Broadway? We saw it on Broadway too, but we saw it off Broadway. And I remember being like, who is that with you? And Steve knew exactly who you were because you were also in the original off Broadway Company of I Love You, You're Perfect Now Change.
That's right.
Which is one of Steve's favorite shows.
That's right. That show ran for 12 years off Broadway and it changed my life. Hopefully by the time this pilot airs, we will have just done Death Becomes Her in Chicago.
Yes, you're going to start Death Becomes Her in Chicago and then on Broadway.
Yeah, so I get to play the Goldie Hawn part and I'm just tickled pink about it.
Oh, I love you so much. Tell me about your how you came to the Golden Girls. Has it just always been there for you?
Oh, well, I first saw it, you know, I'm Gen X, so I used to watch it at my grandmother's house.
Yeah.
And I recognized it was funny, but, you know, I was still a kid. And then when I moved to New York in my 20s, I started watching it like on reruns and stuff. And I was like, wait a minute, hold the phone. And then, of course, I ordered the DVD set and I started to go home and watch it with my mother. And the two of us just dove right in. And in fact, it's the last thing I actually watched with my mother in her, before she passed away. It was the episode where Rose is on the cruise and, you know, makes love for the first time after her marriage.
Wait, is it Arnie or is it Miles?
We have to go look and do a deep dive because
it's the same,
actor.
But we don't know which character.
Like, remember, she says, hold me.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I watched The Golden Girls in its original airing on Saturday nights because it came on just before Sisters on NBC. I was in like fifth or sixth grade or something. I was a blooming gay slut and I loved it all. I just like...
You were Blanche at
that age. I was Blanche. And my mom was like a poor alcoholic in recovery lesbian who just did not have time to try to steer me towards more wholesome choices.
Mm-hmm.
So she was fine. We would watch it together and just laugh and laugh. Like the episode where we learned that Blanche's initials are bed.
Oh my God, your initials spell bed?
Do you have a favorite Golden Girls episode?
Oh, well, in our coffee clutch meeting.
Yes.
When we talked about this, remember we had to write them down on a notepad?
Oh my God, I forgot we did that. Yeah.
Oh, well, I remember mine. Do you remember yours? Do you want to reveal them now?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I have so many favorites. It's hard. It's like picking your favorite child, right?
Yeah.
But if pressed, I love Murder Mystery Weekend.
Oh, that's a good one. That is a good one. Mine, I think, is in the first season. It's the Dr. Jonathan Newman one.
Oh, God. Matt Doyle and I talked about it so much.
Shrimp. I mean, it is so good.
So good.
Should we get started?
Let's do it.
So cheesecakes. Is that what we should call our listeners? Our listeners are officially called the Cheesecakes.
That's
so good. So episode one is called The Engagement. Now, I've seen it in places just be called The Pilot and in other places be called The Engagement.
The Engagement. It aired September 14th, 1985.
September 14th, 1985. The world is about to change.
Yeah,
world is about to change.
Oh. This show.
I'm trying to imagine like being home on that Saturday night and like for the very first time hearing that.
Thank you for being a friend.
And
do-do-do-do.
I'm obsessed. It's written by Susan Harris. It's directed by Jay Sandrich. Now, I have some trivia for the episode that I'm going to sprinkle throughout.
Yeah.
But I wanted to point out at the top, this episode won an Emmy for Outstanding Technical Direction, which sounds like a weird thing to like care about. But when you watch the episode, the way that it flows so seamlessly is kind of magical. The way that it goes from like room to room and, mm-hmm. and like, I don't know, technically it feels like a very well-directed episode.
It does, and forgive me for popping your balloon, but I noticed some things that don't continue later in the series that kind of jarred me a little bit regarding the technical filming of it. So we'll talk about that as we
get
there.
Oh my God, okay, great.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so like, you know, you watch the opening credits now. We're seeing like scenes from the series that we haven't seen yet because it's like it's the pilot episode, right?
Right, and the first thing I noticed was the billing. Now, and what I found most interesting about the billing was that it's not in alphabetical order. Rue McClanahan kind of got the shit end of the stick.
Who's billed first?
So Beatrice Arthur. It's always so weird to see her name. It's just B. Arthur. You're like, Beatrice. You know?
She's the opposite. Like, she's the best, but she's the opposite of like a classy Downton Abbey.
Just a Shakespearean, that well-known Shakespearean actress, Beatrice Arthur.
Can you imagine?
But I think she was the most famous at that point because of Maude.
Yes, of course.
Then Betty White, arguably the second most famous because of Mary Tyler Moore.
Yes.
She played Sue Ann Nevins. And then Rue McClanahan is third.
But she was
Vivian Harmon also on Maude.
Maude, she was like in Mama's Family or something.
Yeah, right before that. But she it's just interesting to me that Betty White, they considered, I think, a bit more famous because, I mean, W came before M.
Right.
And then Estelle Getty, a theater actress not known on television at all.
Isn't that wild
that
this came to her so late in her career?
So late in her career. And she's got the prestigious position of and Estelle Getty.
Oh.
It makes sense if you think about it because she's the mother. She's sort of separate from them.
Yes. But she was initially not meant to be on every episode. So she was kind of always going to be like on every couple of episodes. And then that changed after the filming of the pilot.
Yeah.
So it opens at the end of the theme song. And we get that iconic transition theme music. Which just makes me want to pick up a chair. I don't know why. It makes me want to move something.
Really?
My favorite moments in the transition music are in the episodes where a car pulls into the driveway and then like the driver's side door opens but nobody gets out. Or like the car pulls into the driveway and the trunk opens but nobody gets out of the car.
Do you know, I saw the house in person. I think it was on a Disney World tour.
Yes.
Right?
Well, it's in two locations. They have the set of the house is on the Disney World.
Like, that's what I saw.
But then there's the real house, which I think I want to do a deep dive on at some point too, because the real house is like in California.
And a road trip.
And a road. Okay, we'll do like a live episode from right in front of that house.
On the lawn.
I know. Totally.
On the lawn and I. Yeah. Come on. I live there in my head, so
it was
why not?
Just on the market like last year. I think it sold for like $3 million.
It sure did.
Can you imagine?
Yes.
And the inside looks nothing like it, what it looks like in the show.
Well, praise Jesus for that.
I know.
I mean, that's very, we're in the
I know.
Talk about that in a second.
I know. So Dorothy is the first to enter. And my first note is she's just dressed like a paper bag.
Yeah.
She's wearing that like paper bag brown overshirt with like the mustard yellow undershirt.
Mm-hmm.
And she enters through the front door carrying a briefcase the size of a car. She's like coming home from a long day of substitute teaching. Like, what's in the briefcase, B? What's in there, girl?
I know.
Can I just say, as she passes through the living room, we get a glimpse of the living room for the first time. Now, despite the wicker furniture, I think it's kind of nice.
Well, there's a lot of space in this living room as
and
New Yorkers.
Skylights and stuff.
And then I'm obsessed not with the furniture in the front, but there's all these seating nooks in the back.
I know.
And a very fake looking fireplace that's never been lit.
No. And there's like another whole table back. There's like a glass top table.
Yeah.
The lighting is very dim.
Picture them playing their late night gin rummy.
I know. And it is like that space that never gets used.
Ever.
But it looks kind of classy.
Except for those horrible cinder block walls right outside the front wall. At the front door?
Yes. That is a weird entryway right there. And it, like, when you see the house from the outside, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
But then she walks into the kitchen.
Right.
And there's a man cooking at the stove. Who's the man at the stove?
Well, I have the answer. It turns out it's Coco the cook.
I know.
What's that?
Enchiladas rancheros.
Why don't you just shoot me?
And he's cooking on a beautiful 1980s electric range.
Yes.
Speaking of brown, you said her brown paper bag outfit, that beautiful brown refrigerator.
Oh, my God. Well, so this is the thing. We're in the kitchen now, and I've got some trivia about the kitchen because I'm a little bit obsessed. Because the kitchen, to me, is in stark contrast to, like, the softness of the living room. And the kitchen is just sort of this, like, ugly. It looks like the kitchen I grew up in, where there's, like, food stains on the floor and that really harsh overhead lighting. And it's like everything is yellow and like it's decorated like horrendously. But that kitchen set comes from another TV show. It's from a TV show called It Takes Two, starring Patty Duke Aston and Helen Hunt and Anthony Edwards. And it was owned by NBC, the TV show, and so was the set. And so they just kind of had it in storage. And when the pilot was reworked, like the day or two before shooting, they needed a kitchen set because initially they didn't have a kitchen set in the pilot. And they're like, well, we'll just throw in this trashy kitchen set and make it work later. Like, we'll rework it after we record the pilot, but then it just never did.
You know what I love about that is people think of TV and Broadway as so glamorous, but everyone's trying to save a buck where they can. Everyone. You know, NBC's no different, right?
Totally.
Yes. They're just like, well, why wouldn't we?
Totally.
You know?
It's wild because if you look on YouTube, you can see video of like Helen Hunt, like in a different room, like young Helen Hunt, like from like Girls Just Want to Have Fun era. If you don't know it, look it up. Oh my God, it's like my favorite movie. So gay. And she like runs out of the living room into the kitchen and all of a sudden she's like in the Golden Girls kitchen.
One day I want to do a deep dive of all the copper things that are hanging on the wall. Like there's a lobster, I think. For the longest time, I was like, is that a penis? What is that?
People think it's a penis.
People
thing.
Think it's a dick. It's a lobster. It's a lobster.
I love the idea of like Rose just like staying up late one night making her penis cakes. You know what I mean? She like sells them along with her bacon, lettuce, potato sandwiches.
Right? And so naive.
I know.
So there's Dorothy bitching about her day. Rose comes in also after a stressful day, right?
Yes.
She volunteers at the grief counseling center. So they both have these noble professions that they both appear not to like very much, right? at this juncture. So Blanche comes in looking to borrow Dorothy's real, not fake fur, because hi, it's 1985.
So this is the thing, because like Blanche's got a date that night and she's borrowing Dorothy's mink stole.
Yeah.
Dorothy strikes me as the least likely of all of them to have a mink stole.
Well, they were very fashionable in Brooklyn. And she just brought it with her to warm, sweaty, balmy Miami.
And you feel like then it would have been given to her as an anniversary
right.
gift or something because
yeah,
they spent seven seasons talking about how ugly she is and how mannish and like unfeminine she is. Because then Blanche also wants to borrow Rose's earrings. And I'm like, Blanche, do you not own anything, girl?
Well, she does own something. Those epaulettes on her shoulders, yes. Right? They're the size of Dade County. Honestly, just bravo, Blanche.
The other thing, too, you notice mm-hmm. right away is that Blanche doesn't have the accent.
No, that develops in later seasons,
yeah.
Right? And speaking of that, it's funny. And you, I'm going to talk about that in a second. All these actresses find their vibe later on.
Totally.
Especially past season one. And I think the best example of that is probably Bea Arthur.
Yes.
Her tone at the beginning, to me, is very much more, it's much more like the Maude model.
Yes.
And in subsequent seasons, her vibe is so much more nuanced and subtle. And here it's a little broader and angrier. And the first time I really noticed it, where she's like, Blanche, who is Harry?
Blanche, who is Harry?
And then later,
yes.
She might just be like, Blanche, who is Harry? Right. Like, just dry, still. She was so much more dry and
yes.
still. Would you agree?
Yes, 100%.
She, and this is a hard thing to say about such a diva that we love so much, but I think she would get the most improved award.
I agree.
You know?
Because the Blanche thing is, it feels like it transitions from the pilot to like the next episode. Because they said she came back to them after the pilot and was like, I wanted to do like a Mae West thing. And they're mm-hmm. like, why don't you just like give us a Southern accent? And then all of a sudden it's there. You think about like Karen Walker from Will and Grace mm-hmm. and how he really took her like the full season. You could hear it getting a little higher and a
yeah.
little more nasally.
Because you're lived in the characters. I
yes.
mean, I can relate to this just from a theatrical point of view.
Yeah.
The longer you live in a character, the more you find and it becomes much more grounded.
Yes.
Because you know who they are.
Right.
And you don't really know at the beginning. And I hazard to guess these are some smart women. I'm sure they went back and looked at the dailies and went, oh,
right.
Oh, you know, because there's, and they just adjusted.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the costumes for just a second because
yes.
you see Dorothy like in the brown paper bag shirt and the mustard yellow undershirt. And then you see Rose come in that like beautiful blue and pink, like 1950s mm-hmm. house dress.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, and then you've got like Coco, the gay chef standing at the oven wearing like the floral print.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking like, what are they trying to tell? Like a pilot, you probably know about, like as an actress, you know better than I do, but like a pilot has to get so much done very
yes.
quickly.
Yes.
And one of the ways I think they're trying to tell us about these characters is through their clothes. So like Dorothy's a little bit frumpy,
mm-hmm.
but she's, you know, but that's like a working woman's outfit. Whereas like...
Always. They always had her in like the blazers and long trousers.
Yeah,
she was sort of, I think she created palazzos before they were a thing.
Yes.
And by the way, I do have a note about the costume designer's name is Judy Evans.
Oh.
And I talk about it later in the episode, how good she was
yes.
at coordinating their Miami Vice colors.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
they were all in different shades of pastels.
Yes, because that's what Rose is wearing. And we'll learn later that Rose was very much like a housewife. And, you know, she sort of dresses like what I imagine June Cleaver's outfits really
yeah,
look like.
My grandmother was a seamstress by trade.
Oh, yeah.
And she used to make her own dresses and patterns. And she would, at this era, she would pattern all of her dresses like Rose because she was built like Betty White.
Really? Would she actually make them like, I'm going to make a dress like, really?
Yes, she did. Meme.
Mm-hmm. I'm obsessed. Yeah. But I think it tells you something about the characters right away. Like, Dorothy's more severe, and then Rose is a little bit sweeter.
Right.
You know?
And Blanche is all about the curves.
Yes. Now, Blanche is going out with a guy named Harry, and they've been on, what, like 3 dates this week?
They've been on dates, and Blanche does break the news to the gals that Harry has proposed.
Yes.
And I have to tell you, Patrick, they all run to the living room, and the first thing that I notice is that our beloved living room set is in the wrong position for my brain.
Oh.
It's more on a diagonal. Go back and look, as opposed to what we're used to seeing.
Oh,
it's just
you're
like the
right.
one shot. I was like, wait a minute.
Right.
You know? And that's what they do, of course, in television. Wherever the camera is,
yeah.
they'll set it up differently, but it kind of threw me. I was like, wait a minute.
Well, because also, like, Coco follows, and I've got so many questions about Coco, right? So he's in the kitchen, and he's, like, making them dinner. He's making them, like, enchiladas. Dorothy is not happy about it.
Nope,
and,
she's not.
But, like, what is his role? Like, I know, obviously, he's only going to be with us for the pilot, and he's my whole deep dive, so I got a lot of information on him coming your way. But, like, what is his, like, is he always on the clock? Does he live there?
Well, he does, because we're getting ahead, but, you know, we see him in a bathrobe later, and what really confuses me is that Blanche must have come into money from George Devereaux, or her, what we learn later was her life growing up, because we've already established this. Dorothy is a substitute teacher.
Yes.
Rose volunteers at a grief counseling center, and we learn later that Blanche volunteers at a museum. These aren't exactly wealthy positions, but they have enough money to hire Coco the cook.
A cook, right. And like in my deep dive about him, I learned that
live there.
Initially, I think the thought was they wanted the women, in the original thought, and this gets changed, but they wanted the women to sort of be a little wealthier than middle class, and they wanted them to be, like, after a lifetime of cooking and cleaning for their kids and husbands, they hired, you know, a chef or whatever.
Okay.
But like when you see him in like the middle of the night, and like he's sitting there casually chatting, but then all of a sudden he's like, tea, Sophia? And you're like, wait, are you always working? Or
well, and to that point, I will say that when Sophia does arrive, and we'll get there, I'm like, well, where does Coco sleep? Are Coco and Sophia sleeping together? Sophia's in Dorothy's bed, presumably.
We have the benefit.
I have so many questions about Coco.
Same. And unfortunately, we'll never get the answer, because Coco gets evicted as soon as this episode is over.
Yeah.
And talking about, this is so wild, we'll get into their ages in a second, but in talking about this date that Blanche is going on, they are talking about men in Miami in their 50s.
He doesn't talk loud at the movies, doesn't take his own pulse, and he's still interested.
In what?
Rose, if you have to ask, it does not matter anymore.
We were talking about 55-year-old men, which made me, I wanted to do a breakdown of everybody's age.
Right.
So we have Blanche, who we learn in the episode is about 53. Rue McClanahan was 51. Dorothy is between 53 and 55, but Bea Arthur was 63. Rose in season one is confirmed to be 55. Betty White is 63. And Sophia is 79. And Estelle Getty is 62 at the start of filming.
I want to say this right now. This bitch is 53.
I mean, look at you.
Right. But the idea that Blanche Devereaux at the pilot is younger than I am now.
I know.
I'm going to need a moment.
I know.
I would go in for the Golden Girls now.
I know. No, because, like, that's the whole thing. Like, this was 1985.
And they're, oh, no.
I know. But, like, our perception of age has just completely changed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, but also what's out there available to people for beauty, everything's changed,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of when I was a kid, Dynasty, that commercial with Linda Evans from Dynasty, and she's like, 40 isn't fatal, because I think 60 is the new 40 now.
Totally.
These bitches look good now.
I mean, because
they look good then. Like,
yeah.
But now there's, you know, all that Restylane and all that stuff and laser treatments.
Right.
You know, all this stuff.
Science.
Well, Blanche runs to the bedroom. She says, so he asked me to marry him. I'm going to go put on my face. Right.
Which
she runs to the bedroom.
She says, I'm going to go put on my face. She has more makeup on than a drag queen in a RuPaul's season finale. And she's going to go put her face on.
Yeah. Right. So she goes in there with her fully beat face.
Yeah.
And this is where we learn from Rose that the house is actually Blanche's. And
right.
Yes. And she's wondering what's going to happen to them. You know, our roommate status. If Blanche says yes. Oh, my God.
What if she marries him? What'll happen to us? This house is hers.
Then we'll move.
We can't afford to buy a house. What do we have for collateral? A gay cook?
Oh, come on, Rose. Nobody is getting married. Now let's go talk to Blanche.
Dorothy, we'll become bag ladies.
So they run to the bedroom.
And this is like, I gotta tell you, I'm on Rose's side here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, I think it's a little bit inconsiderate of Blanche to not mm-hmm. be thinking about this.
Right.
You know?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. That's later. But
we
yeah.
get that later. And yeah. it is kind of like, oh my God. Like, yeah, I know you and I know me. And if either one of us were in a situation where people were living in our homes mm-hmm. and we might be getting married, the first thought that we would be having is to explain what's going to happen to them.
Full codependent Kathy's right here.
Right.
Oh, for sure. That's my nickname, codependent Kathy. Yeah. I'm so worried about what the other people. Are they
Same.
Okay? You know?
We also, they're running to Blanche's bedroom, which is on the lanai.
Thank you. And this know? Is what I'm talking, yeah, there's like 75 atomizers on yeah. her beauty station.
I don't know what any of this stuff is. I'm looking at her
the
beauty
perfume.
Station.
Yeah. Nail polish. All it is like nail polish and
yes.
like 75 perfumes. And a decor that rivals Palm Sunday.
I know. Okay, wait. So if we could take a second, if you'll indulge me, I'm obsessed with Blanche's wallpaper.
I'm obsessed too. I need to hear about it.
As a good gay, I did a little bit of a deep dive on the iconic wallpaper in Blanche's bedroom. So here's what I learned. In 1942, interior designer Don Loper was hired to help decorate the yet-to-be-built new wing of the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Hmm.
And he wanted to do something striking for the hotel's coffee shop, something that would evoke the easy-breezy attitude of the hotel's beautiful Oceanside location. And so the beautiful green palm leaves design was born. He invented it like specifically for the coffee house. The pattern is called Martinique and was custom designed specifically for the fountain coffee room at the Beverly Hills Hotel, where it remains a fixture today.
That's
which
amazing.
I'm dying to go see. And they say the hotel has even put together its own website. If you go to the hotel's website, you can see places that have used this iconic design, including the restaurant Indochine here in New York City.
Oh, well, we have to go not only to Indochine, but we've yes. got to go this in Los Angeles.
I can't believe I've never been to the Beverly Hills Hotel. I'm yeah. obsessed with LA. I'm obsessed with hotels.
Yeah.
I have been to Indochine, though.
Okay.
And I remember seeing it and being like, that's the wallpaper from... Like, I just always assumed it was created for Golden Girls. But no, they copied mm-hmm. the design from this, like, iconic designer, which I guess is meant to tell us something about Blanche, that she's, like, fancy and would know
yeah.
this, like, Martinique design or whatever.
Right, of course.
But I loved it. Like, you think it's tacky?
I don't love it in her bedroom because it's used to excess.
Yes, because it matches
the
bedspread.
I actually do like it in small doses.
Yeah. It's really pretty. And I feel like when we go to LA, we'll go to the Beverly Hills Hotel and we'll have coffee in the Fountain Blue.
Up the date.
Oh, it's not just the wallpaper either. It's
the
like
bedspread.
The bedspread.
But I also love it for Blanche because you know she's just a cat in the sack. You know? She's just a jungle cat in the sack.
Totally.
Anyway, so we learn at this point, this is where we learn that Blanche has taken on these roommates because she's in fact a widower.
Yes.
And we learn that her husband's name was George.
And I kind of love, like, they're talking about, like, what's going to happen. Is she going to say yes? Is she going to say no?
Blanche, your friend Harry wants an answer tonight. What are you going to tell him?
I haven't decided. I guess I'll know when I hear it come out of my mouth.
You'll know when you hear it come out of your mouth. This isn't a belch, Blanche. This is marriage. Will you look at this? She has more colors than Benjamin Moore paints.
You mustn't rush into anything, Blanche. You hardly know him.
I just wonder what my husband George would think about me and Harry.
Well, if he was alive, he probably would not like it.
This one, she's talking about her husband, George, and she's saying, like, I just wonder what George would think. And we get a little bit more character development because, you know, we get this kind of, like, spiritual round robin of, like, of Rose saying, like, George knows how you feel about him. You have a direct line to him just by thinking it. And I thought it was really sweet. And it was like, you know, there she is in her, like, 50s house dress. And, oh, now we know she's, like, a little bit spiritual. And she's also very, like, I don't know, she's going to be, like, the soft, sensitive one.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Their character development from the pilot is pretty clear.
Yes.
Even though, as we discussed, it gets a bit more nuanced later.
And also, Blanche's only known Harry for a week.
You know, she's a very sexy woman and a slut.
I know, but she's talking about it as though, like, this is going to be her last chance at love, as though she's going to be dead in a week, mm-hmm. you know? She's 51 and the clock is a ticket.
This is it. My feet are already in the box.
I know. I just hope I have my student loans paid off by 51.
Oh, Jesus. Well, at this point, we're interrupted by a ring at the doorbell.
Yes.
And who is it, Patrick?
Well, everyone thinks it's going to be Harry, but no, it's Ma. It's Estelle Getty. She's shown up at the house because her retirement home has just burned to the ground.
That's right.
Ma, what's the matter?
Everyone is fine. No one died. The home burnt down.
My God, are you all right? How'd you get here?
I hitched.
Ma.
A cab. I took a cab.
Well, you should have called.
I'm perfectly capable of managing by myself. I don't need help. I'm a totally independent person.
I know.
I need $67 for the cab.
And I'd like to point out that Dorothy and Rose enter from what is the Lanai area. But this is one of my questions, Patrick, for future episodes. I guess Blanche's bedroom does also enter onto the Lanai, but in future episodes, I swear to God, she goes down the other hallway.
Oh, this is the only time. So we don't even know in this version, in the pilot, we don't know where the
Lanai are.
Right?
But
how would you even get to the Lanai? You know what I mean? Like, we see them on the...
Right. Because we have institutional memory because we know the show. But in this pilot episode, that's what I was mostly referring to about the technical aspect of it. I was like, well, I know that's outside.
Right.
And I get a picture in the credits where Blanche is wearing that dress and she's strutting, moving her shoulders like this, like that. I swear it's the other hallway.
It is. And this was part of the problem with the pilot, because when they were adding the kitchen, that is what threw everything off. Jillian, my co-host on TCO, gave me an architectural rendering of the house for a housewarming gift.
Okay. She's my heroine. Wow. Okay. Also,
I know, but it's beautiful.
So
but
nerdy.
It comes with a whole thing explaining how the layout of the house makes no sense.
It really doesn't.
It does. Because, like, Blanche's bedroom is going to get moved down the other hallway where all the other bedrooms are. The Lanai is going to go out where Blanche's bedroom currently is.
Right. And it's Miami. So I'm guessing there's not a basement.
Right.
And stairs. It's one level living. Again, where is Coco sleeping?
I don't know. We're so concerned about
Coco. We're so concerned about Coco. I do want to point this out, that when Sophia comes in, much like Dorothy, we're going to go on a hair journey with these two women. Sophia is sporting this terrible side part, right? And Dorothy, again, her hair gets so much better later on.
Her hair gets so much better.
We had to do a deep dive on the hair alone. I swear to God.
I couldn't agree more. Okay. She actually ages in reverse on the... Like,
she does!
You know what I mean?
Her fashion sense... Sorry, Judy Evans.
I know.
It gets better.
It gets better. By season 7 of The Golden Girls, she looks younger than she ever did on Maude. Like, if you ever watch an episode of Maude, she looks like she's like Dorothy's Bornax grandmother.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And as far as Sophia goes, I think they were just trying to make her look like a frail old lady here in the pilot, because she looks terrible. And starting in like episode 2, she looks like the Sophia that we come to know.
Well, and you know too, and I'll say this as an actress, professional actress, at this point too, you have so many cooks in the kitchen because the show is not tried and true and hasn't won all the awards that it's going to win.
Yes.
So ostensibly, we're to believe that once the show becomes the hit that it becomes, there's a bit more trust involved across the board, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, at this point, I'm sure they were very concerned about, well, we've got to make her look old enough. We'll talk about that later, I think, in our deep dive. But, you know, when you let things breathe a little bit, that's when you get a little bit more magic, right?
I totally agree.
No, I just want to say this, too. One of the brilliant things, though, about these two women, as Sophia and Dorothy, and I have that in this section, is they instantly are a sight gag. Just their differences in their height.
Right.
You know, it's that classic Guys and Dolls thing.
Yes.
You know, like, it's just really smart casting.
I totally agree.
And Sophia, this is when she enters, this is where we discover that her acid tongue is a remnant from her having had a stroke, which is why she can't control the acerbic jibes that come out of her mouth.
Sit down, Sophia. You must be exhausted. Why? I rode in the cab. I didn't push it. Sophia, honey, how nice to see you.
Who are you?
It's me, Blanche.
You look like a prostitute.
Which I did a double take when we got that in the pilot because I was even reading a New York Times article about this today. They never come back to this. The reason that Sophia just says all the mean things that come to her mind is because she apparently had a stroke that broke the part of her brain that...
They use the word broke.
Yes. That, like, that does the filter where you're like, I shouldn't say mean things. And they never come back. Going forward, she's just a mean old lady. But, like, at least in the pilot, we get an explanation as to why.
Right. Which seems... No offense, but it seems like such a convenient...
Totally.
It's so the TV show can happen.
Right. So it's like you don't hate her for being mean. You kind of love her for being
mean. Right, exactly.
There's a moment where Harry is like, where he's introduced to everybody. And Sophia, this is like a pattern with Sophia. She does not like patronizing compliments about her age. So he makes a crack that like, oh, Sophia, you must be Blanche's sister and you must be blind. And so like they're going back and forth and then Blanche and Harry leave and she she says to the room, the man's a scuzzball, and it gets this huge laugh. They had to reshoot that because initially she had called him a douchebag, and it got such a big laugh, but it didn't make it past standard, so they had to reshoot it, but it gets a huge laugh.
I love that, and I love, since we're on that topic, the pause that Bea Arthur takes, and they do a take to one another, the power of comedy just from a look.
Yes.
And holding for the laugh with your partner, because that creates a second round of laughter.
All right. Thanks, ladies. It was a pleasure.
Nice meeting you, Harry. Have fun. The man is a scuzzball.
Totally. And the chemistry between Bea Arthur and Estelle Getty is instant.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'll learn, you know, like, you know, one of the things we know about Estelle Getty is that she has extreme stage fright. And the week leading up to the pilot, she was like a nervous wreck. And I don't think it was going very well. And they say that, like, they turned the lights on and she just came alive. So it's kind of amazing to see, like, you can almost, like, I'm just, like, envisioning the future episodes where, like, Dorothy puts her hand over Ma's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you feel like probably a lot of that stuff was just ad-libbed and they're so funny together.
Or My Murder Mystery Weekend, a throat. Not part of the show, people, not part of the show. I digress. So Harry arrives at the house. We see Harry, and he and Blanche go off on their date. And so at this point, Rose and Dorothy talk about how they all met, which was by answering an ad in a supermarket. And then Rose starts to give a thematic speech of basically what the entire series ends up being about.
Right.
Yeah, she doesn't use the words chosen family, but essentially that's what it is, chosen family.
It's not fair, you know. I mean, we get married, we have kids, the kids leave and our husbands die. Is that some kind of a test? You don't work that hard. You don't go through everything you go through to be left alone. We are alone, Dorothy. We really are. Our families are gone, and we're alone. And there are too many years left, and I don't know what to do. Get a poodle.
This really hit me as, like, that must be, and she says there's too many years left. Like, she's, like, Rose is supposed to be in her mid-50s. She's got another 30, 40 years left, whatever. And you're like, yeah.
Right, and she's been, this is something that confused me, because we find out later that she's been a widower for 15 years.
I know, I didn't notice that until this watching of it.
Yeah, so what, she was 40 when she lost her husband?
And so, like, were the kids still living? I mean, I guess she probably had the kids when she was very young or whatever. So maybe the kids had, like, just moved out. But she's been without her husband for 15 years.
Yeah.
But this monologue really hit home with me. I thought it was really beautiful. And I was really, because Rose, more than any of them, is the most terrified that Blanche is going to say yes. And then they're going to have no word. I'm very worried about money for these ladies. I'm very, like, how much money do they have in the bank? What would they actually do? Where would they go?
Well, thank God they can afford cocoa.
I know.
Thank God. Who's going to make them enchiladas?
No. I mean, is it going to be Rose's beach friends in the future?
Who's going to, as we see next, pour them iced tea late at night, which I'm hoping is Long Island iced tea.
Thank you. Me too.
So now we're out on the lanai, which, as we've established, I think Patrick and I, we both live there in our minds, right?
I also cannot say the lanai.
It's hard. I think I just messed it up. It's 10 times fast.
The lanai, the lanai.
Cheesecakes, try it. The lanai, the lanai. I can't do it.
Come on, cheesecakes. The lanai, the lanai.
Nope.
The lanai. It's a
Because you really have to put a break in between,
yeah,
right?
The lanai.
The lanai. I can't do it. Damn it.
The lanai, the lanai, the lanai. Yeah.
Oh, that was good.
But you have to really pause.
I don't know. I still didn't do it.
The lanai. I can't do it.
Cheesecakes. It's up to you. So Dorothy, Rose, and Coco are all, they're all out on the lanai.
The lanai.
In their bathrobes.
Yes.
So we know now that Coco does sleep over.
And, like, is he always on the clock?
I guess so.
I want to know that he goes into his room at night and just drinks. You know what I mean?
And that iced tea, I'm like, well, you know there's a lot of caffeine. Is it spiked?
I know.
The Long Island iced tea.
I hope it is.
Anyway, Rose is convinced that Blanche will say yes. She's still worried.
She's pacing.
And she gives, ladies and gentlemen, a masterclass in comedy, in the sense of marrying the spoken word with physical comedy.
Cheesecakes, you gotta go to our Instagram right now if you wanna see Jen act out this moment. I promise you it is the funniest thing you'll see today. Our handle is at Golden Girls Deep Dive. Go watch, it's already up. Go look at it, you're gonna die.
It's yes, I know it is. She's gonna marry him.
Oh, come on, Rose.
She can't help it. Blanche needs a man. She told me when George died, she made a date at the funeral. Oh, not that she didn't love George. She can't be without a man. You know what I'm saying?
And then Dorothy makes a school shooting joke.
Yep.
She literally says, what am I doing up? I'm subbing for a teacher that was shot by a student. I need all the sleep I can get. Dorothy, savage.
Welcome to 1985 in America.
The fact that Dorothy makes a school shooting joke. Read the room, Dot.
Dot, thank you for that. So so our bathrobed heroes come back into the living room, right? Heroines. I'm also obsessed that here we are late at night, as you mentioned before, Patrick, about Rue. But here, especially Betty White, if you look closely, the lip gloss is, it could light the sky. I don't know about you, but when I get dressed in my pajamas, I'm in full beat.
Same.
Always.
So Blanche comes home and Rose practically jumps out of her seat. What happened? Now, Blanche is being a little coy. And I don't appreciate, because they just want to know if they're going to be homeless next week. And she just wants to talk about the stone crab she had, because she can't eat anything with eyes.
But she does finally tell us that, yes, she is going to marry Harry next week. And I want to point out, Patrick Hines.
Yes.
To look at their faces, go back and watch, because Coco, in this moment, is giving full Patrick Hines in every picture that you take. Yeah, he's just like... That's his face.
I gotta tell you, Coco and I think that, like, I see a lot of myself in Coco.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Coco, I would have done Coco's job. I would have been like on the clock at all times, but I would be drunk after 5.
You would.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I gotta point out, what happens is she says yes, she's gonna marry him. They all make that Patrick Hines face. They're all shocked. It goes to commercial. It comes back. They're all in the exact same position, but Coco's gone. Did you notice? Coco's gone. And like, it's a little bit of a mess,
right?
Because, and this is part of my deep dive. Well, you'll find out, but like, they reshot the pilot. So like, he's in, they try to cut him out of as much as they possibly could. The poor guy.
So Blanche goes off to the bedroom, and his exit line, I'd like to point out, is to say they are going to honeymoon in New York, where she hopes she doesn't get murdered. You know, New York in the 80s. It was a little rough.
Have you seen that that 30 Rock where the lady's walking out, I love spring in New York, and then some person like throws her into a pile of garbage.
So, as we've established, both Rose and Blanche are widowers, but here we learn for the first time that Dorothy is a divorcee.
Yeah, so Dorothy had a shotgun wedding that Rose thought was a blowgun wedding. Dorothy's dad made Stan, her ex-husband, marry her because she was pregnant. And they were married for 38 years, and we learn that he left her for a stewardess named Chrissy.
It was her first flight. They said on arrival, give the passengers a lay. She got confused. He got lucky, and they now live on Maui.
So now we jump to the day of the wedding. We're in Blanche's bedroom. Dorothy is in there, and Rose rushes in. Blanche's bedroom is the room that keeps on giving, because now we learn that there's like a dressing room and a bathroom back in the corner. This is a huge bedroom.
I'm sure it's somehow connected to the lanai. Did you hear me struggle? to the lanai.
You can't do it.
I can't do it.
Oh, my goodness.
But here we have 12 minutes to spare until the wedding, and Rose and Dorothy engage in some brilliant physical comedy, this physical comedy dance.
Because what's happening is Rose is now saying she doesn't trust Harry. There's something about Harry. She's got a hunch. And Dorothy is saying, like, shut up. Blanche is marrying him. You're just afraid that we're going to be kicked out on the street. Like, I'm not going to let you ruin this.
I'm going to tell her.
You are not. I will not let you.
I can't stop crying. I'm so happy and so sad. Kind of a happy sad.
Speaking of sad,
shut
Blanche.
Shut up, Rose.
She's crying already. What's the difference?
Rose, pick that up.
These actresses, Bea and Betty, are so hilarious. We have a thrown atomizer.
Oh my God.
We have headlocks. What's not to like?
This is where we are introduced to the phrase, shut up, Rose. It's like my favorite thing. But the moment where Dorothy goes, Rose, pick this up, and then throws something across.
One of the atomizers, the perfume. It's so brilliant.
And like, Dorothy is literally flinging Rose around the room to the point where at one point she throws her into the closet and then locks the door.
Also, I love that there's a latch to the closet.
I know.
There's no kids there.
No. And I love that, like, Rose just accepts it. She gets thrown into the closet and she's not banging or pounding on the door to get out.
Until the end. And and Coco inexplicably straightens the palm leaf bedspread that has nary a crease in it. That's just an occupy his business so that Rose yes. can bang on the door.
Yes. Yeah.
But I was like, oh, Coco.
Poor Coco.
There's like, it didn't have quite hospital corners, but there was nothing to fix. It was busy work, right?
100%.
You just snorted.
I know. You're making me laugh.
All right.
Oh, it's so funny.
This is the first spot too, Patrick, where I wanted to give out a shout out to that costumer, Judy Evans, because
yes.
all those ladies in that scene, they're in different pastels of pink, yellow, and blue.
Yep.
They look like an Easter basket.
I was going to say it looks like an Easter wedding
for
sure.
It did. And hilariously enough, I will say that Blanche is not only carrying a bouquet.
Yeah.
But few points docked for the fact that she's also wearing a wrist corsage, as we discover. She comes because they're about to go into the living room. So she's both, in my head, she's the bride and the mother of the bride. All in one? I don't know. I don't know if that's props. I don't know who's in charge of that.
Well, also, like, we're going to meet so many members of her family, like gay brother Clayton down the road. Like, why is nobody here for her wedding? Her sister,
right?
Virginia?
Well,
Big Daddy?
Really fast. They're like, right?
True.
Like, no.
So we cut to the living room. The four women, Coco, and the minister are all there. The minister is real impatient.
Mm-hmm.
It's Miami, ladies. He's got funerals backed up.
Did you notice he carries a pocket watch?
Yeah. Very dapper minister in Miami.
I know.
But he's on a tight schedule, and, like, you know, we learned that Harry is 30 minutes late, and
mm-hmm.
Blanche is a nervous wreck, and the doorbell rings, and Blanche runs over, and it's an officer played by Meshach Taylor.
Is there a Blanche Hollingsworth here?
God, he's been killed.
Arrested.
What?
He gave me this to give to you. He's a bigamist, ma'am. He's wanted in 4 states. He's got 6 wives.
I know. And then that show, Designing Women,
yeah.
would premiere the following year.
Yeah, it was. I was reading an article today that was saying that it was a lot of those shows were like Designing Women and others were kind of like based on the success of this.
Yeah.
You know,
that
you could do a show that was based on like just female driven characters.
And middle aged female women,
yes,
too.
Yes.
It's really thrilling. You
it's
know?
Exciting.
Yeah.
So it's Meshach Taylor. I screamed because I love Designing Women, but I also loved Mannequin, which he would be in like a year later with Estelle Getty.
It's incredible.
And I'm like, when you guys were shooting Mannequin, did you like chat about like the time that you were on the pilot episode of the Golden Girls? Oh my God. No, I gotta say, Rue McClanahan does some acting. She
yeah.
does her face acting
mm-hmm.
in this scene
mm-hmm.
because she thinks that the police officer is here to say that Harry is dead. But he says, no, he's a bigamist. Which I was like, are we allowed to say that word?
Yeah. He's a bigamist. He's wanted in 4 states. He has 6 wives.
Yeah, so Rose was right. Rose
mm-hmm.
was right to be suspicious. And she had said to us in that scene, my hunches are never wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And she's vindicated
well, she's
here again.
She's the most childlike. Like, if anyone can speak to spirits, you know it's Rose,
100%.
Right? She's such a childlike soul.
Yeah. And he wrote, you know, Harry wrote her a letter and Dorothy reads it. It says, Dear Blanche, I guess you know by now. I'm really sorry. The thing is, I really liked you. This time was different. You're a special lady. Maybe you'll write to me someday, Harry.
Mm.
And like, she's really giving the performance. She's really like, she's really acting in
yeah.
this moment.
Yeah. They're not just funny ladies. They can get you
it's
in
true.
The feels.
Blanche feels like a fool, but not just a fool. An old
fool. An old fool.
Oh, poor Blanche.
So then we go out to the lanai. It's 3 weeks later. Sophia
yeah.
is sprawled out on a chaise looking like an aged Hollywood starlet.
And she's got sunglasses on. Dorothy comes out and holds a mirror under her nose just to make sure
mm-hmm.
she's still alive.
Mm-hmm. Which is in my favorite episode, Murder Mystery Weekend, right?
Oh, did she do it again?
I don't know if it's to Sophia, but there's a mirror under a nose, I remember.
I remember that now.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
mention it. But Blanche hasn't come out of her room in 3 weeks.
Three
and they're
weeks.
Saying they've tried everything, golf, movies, theater tickets.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't even budge for Julio Iglesias cheesecakes.
But we then talk about grief a little bit because, you know, Rose brings up how grieving a relationship is similar to grieving the death of a loved one. And Dorothy then goes on a diatribe about the different ways different cultures conduct their funerals, to which Sophia says, just put me in a steel sack and leave me on the curb next to the cans. Which brings up a question for me, Patrick. How do you want to go? What do you want?
Oh, I definitely want to be cremated and probably sprinkled in the theater district and then a little bit in the West Village in front of what was the Oscar Wilde bookstore, opened in 1968, the world's first gay and lesbian bookstore.
Could you be more specific?
I want...
So you've thought about this.
I didn't realize
off the top of my head.
Yeah, I definitely want to be sprinkled in the theater district. Is that morbid?
No, I think it's appropriate. I haven't gone so far as to what to do with my ashes. I do also want to be cremated, but most of all, I've thought about my memorial service.
What's going to happen? Who's singing? Who's singing?
Here's what's going to happen.
Norbert Leo Butz.
I haven't thought about the singing, but I have two people lined up.
Okay.
I definitely have the photograph chosen. It was taken on the Playbill cruise, appropriately enough, where there's a sunset behind me, and it looks like I died, basically. So I have my photo set up. But then I definitely want Tina Fey to do some sort of roast.
You guys, she knows Tina Fey. She's cake. She knows Tina Fey.
No, we're buddies. Yes. I want her to do something really, really funny.
Yes.
And then I want David Hyde Pierce to come in and make people cry.
Yes.
You know?
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah, yeah,
we got to
yeah.
get each of them on an episode of the podcast.
Bernadette Peters. Bernadette Peters will sing something.
Will you give us
like
a little
not
Bernadette?
A day goes by.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Will you give us a little Bernadette right now? Okay. I know you guys are friends, too, and you can't make fun of her.
No, but not a day goes by. You know, that's me so gentle. Good. It's not really an impression.
No.
Yeah. Because I love her.
I know you do.
I do. She's class act.
Oh, God.
But anyway,
Dorothy says, after lambasting the Irish, the Jewish, and the Italians, she says it's the Southern Protestants who make grieving a way of life. Oh, and then as soon as Sophia says that, Dorothy goes, we thought you were asleep. And Sophia goes, you never know.
Which brings in our episode heroine, Blanche. She emerges.
She emerges. And she just says, you know, she's really okay by now. She says she just wanted to give up and die. But it was her friendship with the girls, with Rose and with Dorothy and with Ma that really saved her.
Then this morning I woke up and I was in the shower shampooing my hair and I heard humming. Well, I thought there was someone in there with me. No, it was me. I was humming. And humming means I'm feeling good. And then I realized I was feeling good because of you. You made the difference. You're my family, and you make me happy to be alive.
Well, she found herself humming in the shower, and she's like, wait a minute, that's me, and that's a sign that she's happy.
Yes.
So Rose says she's going to take them all out to celebrate at Coconut Grove.
Coconut Grove
and,
for lunch.
Yeah, she's going to buy my lunch. And Patrick, I think we should do something similar, but here in the theater district. Like, let's go to Junior's and have some cheesecake.
Yes, I love that. That sounds like a really good idea.
You're buying.
I'm buying. But wait, I got to say, this ends in a funny way, because Sophia's not going to go with them to Coconut Grove because her and the fancy man have a date to go to dog track racing later. So, like, a couple of things. Number one, apparently the setup was supposed to be that Sophia and Coco the gay chef were going to become besties. But also, do you remember we learned many, many, many seasons from now that Dorothy had a gambling addiction?
Yes.
I think it's kind of insensitive that her own mother is rubbing gambling in her face right here at the end of the
pilot. Wow. Where's the continuity person?
All right, girl, are you ready for our first ever deep dive?
Yes, let's do it. GGDD.
Yes. Golden Girls deep dive, baby. All right, cheesecakes. For this first episode, I'm doing a deep dive all about the actor Charles Levin, the actor who played Coco, the gay chef in the pilot. Because, like, his journey getting the job is really interesting. And then he died kind of mysteriously decades later. Mm. So Charles Levin was born March 12th, 1949. He had a really solid career of guest star work, like starting in 1975. Coco was not the first time he played gay. And we'll get to more of that in a second. But from its conception, I've learned that the creators of the show wanted there to be a gay character because they said that Miami was like a cool, hip place. There were lots of gays in Miami, and having a gay in the mix felt organic to them. But the show was also meant to just be subversive, like we were talking about a little bit in the regular recording, because just in the act of focusing on women in a way that hadn't been done before, and they said that, like, quote, after society had written them off based on their age, you know, they specifically were being subversive in just in the act of focusing on women at, like, this stage in their life. And they're like, let's really piss people off, throw a gay into the mix. And, like, you know, it made it feel organic. But one of the other things I thought was so interesting was that this really was a first of, like, a show, you know, being so female-oriented without any, like, male leads. And they thought that throwing in a gay male character was a way of having a little bit of male energy without also having any sort of, like, sexual tension in the house, which they didn't want.
Right. And I think they soon realized the magic that the women had just alone.
Right. That's essentially where we get to. So, you know, we talked about this in the episode a little bit too. The idea of the women having a cook in the show was that, like, after years of, like, long, hard days of work taking care of their husbands and kids, that they would have hired somebody to do, like, the housework and the cooking and the cleaning.
Right. And we learned too later that Blanche did come from a bit of money.
So Susan Harris, who created the Golden Girls, had written a fabulous gay character before this one on another show she created called Soap. And we're going to do, girl, I insist, we're doing a whole deep dive at some point on Soap. But famously, the great Billy Crystal played the gay character on Soap, and that character's name was Jodie Dallas.
I loved Soap.
Did you?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We're going to have to cover it.
I can't wait.
Okay, good. Billy Crystal played a character named Jodie Dallas, and he was the first gay series regular character. Mm-hmm. I did a ton of research trying to figure out who the actual first gay character on American TV was, and it's a little bit sort of up in the air, because I think there's some thought that there are some that we thought were gay but didn't necessarily ever come out. The one that is sort of, and like, correct me if I'm wrong, Cheesecakes, I very well, maybe one of you knows for sure, but the first credited gay TV character ever to appear on American TV was All in the Family. There was a character that appears on season 1, episode 5. His name was Steve, and he was played by Philip Carey, and he was like an old friend of Archie Bunker's.
Oh, amazing.
Who, like, Archie doesn't know is gay. And they're
right, because it's also, he's notorious for being,
yeah,
you know,
homophobic,
very bigoted, right. Yeah.
And Bea Arthur was also on that show, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she was a neighbor or something.
Right.
I think that's how Maude came to be.
Correct. Maude was a spinoff
of All in the Family. So,
as far as casting Coco, an early contender for the role was Jeffrey Jones. Do you know who that is?
No.
He was in Howard the Duck. He was the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh.
He was in Beetlejuice.
Sure, sure.
But he took himself out of the running by going into the audition and saying that he didn't think the character was necessary.
Well, he won that fight, didn't he?
I know. You're right.
He
did. Sweet vindication for Jeffrey Jones.
Don't you admire the honesty, too?
Can you imagine? Would you ever do that?
No.
I don't think we need this character that I'm auditioning
for. Higher. I don't think we need this character.
God. But it was apparently the president of NBC himself who suggested Charles Levin because he liked the gay character that Levin played on Hill Street Blues. The character's name was Eddie Gregg, and he was apparently like a male bathroom hustler.
Oh.
And I guess this guy liked the character so much that he wanted to get that character its own spinoff. I have searched high and low on the internet for footage of this character. You can find Hill Street Blues like on YouTube, but I have not been able to find.
This would be a great assignment for the Cheesecake.
Cheesecakes, find us a video of Eddie Gregg from Hill Street Blues. I gotta see what it's like.
Yeah.
But he was very like swishy and flamboyant, very like over the top caricature of like what people thought a gay man was. But apparently he had, like, this character had not a sexual relationship, but, like, an informant cop relationship with one of the cops that was, like, a relationship that people really liked. And so they loved him on that show. They bring him in to read. And, you know, Charles Levin says in reading Coco in the original draft, he found him to be very much like that character. Over the top, even like a little bit lispy and just kind of funny, like very like Birdcage energy. But when he met with the director of the pilot, apparently the director told him, I don't want you to do it like that. I want you to do it straightforward. You're just a guy that happens to be gay. So this is confusing for him. Levin gets brought in for his big audition in front of like all the NBC brass, and he does it the way the director told him to do it and totally bombs. And he didn't feel comfortable doing it. That wasn't how he wanted to do the character, but he just sort of felt like what would you do in a situation like that?
Well, oh God, that's a hard one. As I was saying in the actual episode we just did, it's really hard when there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, especially when they're all named Coco.
But everyone has a different opinion.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you do have to take the note. And the best advice I would give anyone is take the note, but find a way to still make it your own.
Which it seems like he didn't.
Yeah.
It seems like he kind of just went in and did it. Like, and
because if you're in between, it's not going to be committed and it's not going to work.
And it didn't. It totally fell flat. He thought he blew it. And a few days later, the VP of casting called him and was like, we don't know what the hell that was that you just did. Could you just come back in and like do it the right way? So he goes back in and just does it the way that he saw the character, big and flamboyant and over the top, and he totally books it. So the Golden Girls pilot episode is filmed April April 17th, 1985. And it's kind of legendary, apparently, that like this pilot recording was sensational. They say the audience is like buzzing and the actors were buzzing. And it was like one of the best filmed pilots I've read ever happened. So this is where we have to talk about Estelle Getty for a second, because Estelle Getty was the newcomer. She was really nervous during rehearsals. Like we talked about in the regular episode, she had a lot of stage fright. She wasn't really connecting. But like we were saying, when the lights came on, she just like came alive. And you can see this in the episode. Like we were saying, her comedy is effortless. Mm-hmm. And they even describe her later as like the breakout star of the pilot. And like she's like up against these like TV icons. And like she's kind of the breakout star. Now, the audience goes crazy for her. And remember, she was supposed to only be in every couple of episodes. She was, what is it, recurring and not series regular?
Recurring or guest star, yeah.
Yeah. But the audience also goes nuts for Coco. It's not like she was great and he didn't land. Mm-hmm. According to Levin, and Charles Levin has given precious few interviews over the years. It's almost impossible to find any. He did this one really long interview over the course of several days with a blogger. And he only talks a little bit about the Golden Girls. But according to him, everything worked. All of his jokes hit. Everything was really funny. You know, at the end of the filming of the pilot, the creators kind of got together and they're like, well, shit, now what do we do? Mm. Because they're like, we have like five really strong characters. And they say, Susan Harris is like, it wouldn't have done justice to anybody to try to like use all of their talents only a little bit at a time. Also, the pilot was 5 minutes too long.
Yeah, because most sitcoms, what is it, about 22 minutes of material.
Yeah. And it was 5 minutes over. And they said like it made the most sense to bump Estelle Getty up to series regular and sort of cut all of Coco stuff. And like, remember, like it was groundbreaking in the way that it focused like just on four women. And the network had been nervous about that. But after filming the pilot, they realized it really worked. And they're like, all right, let's just get rid of the man and we'll keep it focused on the women. And so the question is, like, is that story really true or was it like homophobia involved? Hmm. And the Golden Girls creators insist that it's not, that they also wanted the women to be more relatable. So they thought if them being able to afford a cook made them a little bit more upper class. They wanted the women to have money troubles so that the audience would kind of care about them and kind of worry about them. So those were all other reasons they said it made more sense to cut Coco.
Do you know, Patrick, if part of it was because they knew who their demographic audience was and it was older women?
No, I've not read that. Okay. In the material that I've read, that's not given as one of the reasons. I think they wanted to take a chance on doing something that was all women-centric, but were nervous to do it. But when they saw how hard it hit and how good it was, they were kind of like,
they felt
okay,
confident.
This kind of works. So Coco is almost completely gone from the pilot. Like, it's funny, before we went back to do this, I remember thinking, oh, right, like in the pilot, there's like the gay chef. When you watch the pilot, he's barely there. There's no character development. He doesn't have any funny lines. He's just kind of there in the background. And it turns out they reshot many scenes of the pilot to try to cut him out of as much as they could. And they gave a lot of his really funny lines to Sophia. And so what's remaining is this like very flat sort of non-existent. He's like in a scene one moment, then you come back from the commercial and he's not there anymore.
Well, that would explain why we were so confused.
Yes. Yes.
Also, the more you talk, the more I feel really bad for the actor.
Yes.
Because I feel like I really know him already. And I feel so badly because he didn't do anything wrong.
He didn't do anything wrong. And he very much in that 2013 blog interview really disputes the idea that it was creative at all. He says it was all linked to homophobia. He doesn't really get into it, but he says that the director of the pilot was homophobic. He says that the casting people at NBC were homophobic and they were kind of looking for any way to cut this character. The blog is The Incredible Culk. If you Google Joey Culkin, The Incredible Culk, Coco, it'll link you right to the 2013 interview. And it's this wild interview because Joey Culkin is like interviewing him via email over many days. And like Charles Levin is kind of like what's the word? He's a little bit aggressive and he's kind of like schooling the guy on how to ask him questions and like he's easily offended. Mm. So he seems like kind of an interesting character, but he says like the character Coco that you see is nothing like what he shot. And he's defensive of his work, saying that it was really funny, it was really good, the character was really interesting, but what you see in the pilot is just like he's been kneecapped.
Oh, that happens so much where lines that you have are cut. And yeah. So the characterization that you're playing doesn't make sense.
Uh-huh.
Which is frustrating.
And it kind of happens in the pilot too, yeah. Where you're kind of like, it's almost like he's doing a different show.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And do you know if the actor is gay? I'm not.
He's not.
He's not. Which is interesting. I just find it germane in the sense that it's interesting that as a straight man, he found them to be homophobic.
But
you could go on and on about this. Well, then, you know, playing the character is a stereotype is, you know, as a straight man. Yeah. It's just,
because it, yeah. Like even today, like you wouldn't cast a straight man in that role.
That's
you know?
Right.
But back then people just weren't out. You really couldn't be out and be like Billy Crystal. Think about like if he were actually gay, like,
yeah.
Like if you were out, it would be the death knell of your career in like the late 70s.
And it
early
was 5
80s.
Minutes ago.
Yeah, I know. Like I was even thinking about like my favorite show of like modern times is Modern Family.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Stone Street, who plays Uncle Cameron, is brilliant, brilliant, brilliant in the role, but he's straight in real life. And you would never cast a straight man in that role now.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So after the Golden Girls, you know, he continues to work. His most notable role after the Golden Girls is that he plays the Moyle on the Seinfeld episode, The Briss.
Oh, gosh.
Which is one of those things where either you, like, I've mentioned this to some people and they know exactly who he is. And if you don't, then you don't. But I watched the episode and he's like a much bigger man. It's 1993, so it's almost 10 years later. He's larger, his hair is gray, and his character is very aggressive, loud, and obnoxious. Whereas Coco was very, like, soft and, like, sweet and cuddly. And I think the role in Seinfeld is more what he was like in real life. Maybe a little bit difficult, a little bit kind of a diva. But it's very funny, and people do love this episode.
Oh, well, if it isn't Shaky the Moyle. Nice job on the circumcision, but it's not supposed to be a finger. The circumcision was perfect. The finger was your fault. You flinched. Oh, who made you a Moyle? Where'd you get your degree from? A matchbook? You see? He flinched to death. Nice Moyle picking, Elaine. You picked a hell of a Moyle. One more peep out of you, and I'm going to slice up like a smoked sturgeon.
Oh, don't threaten me, Butcher Boy.
Butcher Boy!
Do you think... this is rampant speculation. Could who he was as a person been one of the reasons they didn't invite him back?
Could be. Could be.
Because I'm feeling bad for the actor, but I didn't know if he was difficult. I had no idea.
Yeah. His own son describes him. We'll get to it here because we learn that like as his acting career is kind of winding down in the early to mid 2000s, he moves to a small farming town in Oregon called Grants Pass. And they describe him as a gregarious figure in town. His son, Jesse, describes him as a difficult guy around town, a big diva, but also incredibly comedic. And he had a huge personality and was incredibly charming. So those are all adjectives given to us by his son.
Now, is he deceased or is he with us?
Oh, he's dead.
He's
he dead, Jennifer. He dead. His
Your delivery. That's what I was laughing at. Not the fact that he's dead.
No, be clear. His death is kind of a crazy
story. I'm getting ahead of the ball. Okay.
It's okay. In June 2019, the then 70-year-old was in the process of moving from one area of Grants Pass to another. On June 28th, 2019, he's last seen by his friend Julie Hatt. It was like his best friend in town. They had met she worked at the local grocery store. They become close friends. And she was helping him move. This is literally like him just like packing his car and she's helping him pack his car. They're at his current residence and he's driving to his new residence. It's June 28th and she sees him and she waves goodbye. We later find out that later that day, he made a phone call from his cell phone to a family friend. And on the call, he was breaking up and he's described as sounding like confused and lost. And so this all happened on June 28th, 2019. He isn't seen again. And it's not until July 8th that his son, his 34-year-old son, Jesse, reports him missing. So it seems to me like he had become kind of a loner. Like you could go that many days between June 28th and July 8th with nobody seeing you. And no, that's not raising alarms for anybody.
Yeah.
So he's reported missing on July 8th. Instantly, a search party is organized. The search lasts for over a week. And this is in a really rural area of Oregon. It's like out in the wilderness, essentially. They say on Friday, July 12th, they're able to use GPS from that last call, the one where he sounded sort of confused and lost, to narrow their search. And the next day, July 13th, his car is found in what is described as a, quote, incredibly remote area of Grants Pass. Now, the Daily Mail published pictures of where his car was found, and it looks like somebody dropped his car, it's this little orange Fiat, into, like, the middle of the woods. And in the car, they find the decomposing remains of his pug, Boo Boo Bear. How cute is that name?
Boo-boo-bear.
But he's not there. No Charles Levin. So nobody knows where he is. And it's the middle of the night when they find the car. The search commences for him. They're combing this like thick overgrowth. And within a few hours, they find Levin's naked, badly decomposed body at the bottom of a treacherously steep ravine. It was 30 feet down. And, you know, what they believe, they rule out foul play or suicide. Essentially, what they think has happened is that he was driving, he packed his car with his friend, and he's driving to his new house or apartment or whatever. They think that he was taking a back road, because this is a back road that, like, even like local hunters say, we don't even try to take this road. It's so overgrown, and there's like fallen tree fields, so there's like entire areas in the middle of this overgrowth that are like just full of like dead trees. Mm-hmm. And somehow his little car was able to get so much further into it, even further than the emergency response vehicles that are called for him. They were not able to get within a quarter of a mile of where he was found, and his car was like right there.
Right, but a Fiat's not an off-road vehicle.
No, but right? Like, you would think that these are like four-wheel vehicles would be able to, but like, and when you see these pictures, it really looks like the trees grew up around his car. It's right. Wild.
Could they detect if there was car trouble or?
No, it seemed that the car stalled out and that there was like he had been trying to like pull out and pull around. They think what happened was that he got stuck and got out of his car and then fell into the ravine. It doesn't explain why he was naked.
Right.
His son, Jesse, said that he was suffering from, quote, confusion and severe emotional problems at the time of his death. So they've ruled out suicide. They don't think it's that, but
there wasn't there wasn't like a hose and duct tape or anything
no,
like that.
No, okay. Nothing like that. It just seemed like he was having maybe a manic episode of some kind, and he was
got
in the middle of the woods, got disoriented. He was 70 years old and opened his car door to kind of look around and fell into this ravine. Again, we don't know why he was naked.
But I mean, when did this become an episode of True Crime Obsessed?
I know.
Jillian,
no,
step in.
It's like, wild.
It's amazing. It's awful.
It's a terrible.
And the dog.
I know. Poor Boo Boo Bear. I know.
All I can picture is Yogi and Boo Boo every time say that.
I know. Maybe that's who he was named after.
Oh, God.
Well, that's my deep dive on the life and death of actor Charles Levin, Coco the Gay Chef.
Right, everyone. No one can bring a party down better than Patrick Hines.
Wah, wah, wah,
wah. That's usually my secret power. You know that about me.
Yeah, I love that about you. Girl, we got all the way through our very first episode of the GGDD.
We did it.
Did you have a good time?
I had a great time. I hope you had a great time, and I hope the cheesecakes had a good time.
Is everything.
A great time. Why do we have a great time and they have a good time?
Totally. They're slightly disappointed. No, cheesecakes, this is everything I wanted it to be. I'm so happy. But the other thing I want you to do, cheesecakes, come please join our Facebook group. It's the Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast Discussion Group.
That's it.
It's on the Facebook. Something you could do that would really help us out, cheesecakes. Go to Apple Podcasts and write a review. All you got to do is like click the 4 or 5, whatever stars you think we deserve, and write like at least one sentence about what you like about the show.
That would be great. You know? Also, don't forget to follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Golden Girls Deep Dive.
Yeah.
And thank you in advance for, you know, saying I'm pretty in your review. Thank you.
How did you read my review before it even got published? Jennifer Samaran, I love you so much.
I love you too, my friend.
Thank you for making a podcast with me.
Thank you for making one with me, you good person.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
All right, bye.
So that's the first episode. The second episode is already available by searching the Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check it out. I know I will. And look for my album, Looking Back on a Possible End, wherever you get music, and We Couldn't Help But Wonder, Still Wondering, where Elise and I have spent the last year breaking down various New York-centric films on Patreon.com. Elise and I will be back soon.